You're listening to Boston Strongcast, a place where we talk all things powerlifting, strength, and the occasional scientific nerd session. I'm your host, Kevin Kahn, the owner of Precision Powerlifting Systems, strength coach and competitive powerlifter in the USAPL. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get stronger together.
Hey guys, this is Kevin Kahn with Boston Strongcast. I'm going to use this solo episode to kind of update a narrative that I've talked about this in the past, but one of the cool things I think about this podcast is I can actually, you know, you can go back in time to episode one and you can start to see the transition that I've made as a coach. You actually see all the stages of it and how our narratives and how our training has changed over time. And I think that's pretty cool. And actually at the time that the podcast has started, it wasn't, you know, before that is not that much before that podcast, I was doing a lot of like mobility stuff, assessments, corrective exercise. So, you know, I kind of wish that the podcast could even be spread out. You know, I wish I had started it a little bit earlier to catch some of that stuff too. Because at this point, it's kind of cool. It's like it's seeing my growth as a coach. But I want to update a narrative on skill acquisition. So, you know, as many of you know, I've discussed quite a bit and quite at length the dynamic systems theory and a constraints-led approach to coaching. However, when I first started using it, my narrative was incorrect. It's not that I was wrong in what I was doing. It was more I was wrong in the reasons and what I was saying. And I've had this conversation with there's coaches on our team that actually coach other lifters and stuff and tend to have questions about some of this stuff. And I always want to make sure, and I think this is important for everybody else to hear if they're trying to utilize an approach like this or to use certain aspects of this approach. In order for this to actually work, the coach needs to have a strong understanding of the philosophy. It's an easy narrative, even if you get into the perceptual motor landscape stuff. You know, we develop a hypothesis of what the best movement strategy is going to be. And within the framework that I use, within an error minimization framework, you know, our sensory feedback, we're going to kind of try to prove our hypothesis correct. So if we beforehand, if we think a lift is going to be heavy, you know, we'll probably see some breakdown in technique because that sensory feedback of that breakdown is going to kind of be confirming our hypothesis. So we're developing a hypothesis with the lowest amount of error. And that's kind of how we want to see the world. And then this is a much more in-depth topic that maybe I'll get into in another podcast because it's kind of fun and it's kind of interesting and there's so many layers to it that I think people would like it. But that's not what we're going to talk about today. So on the skill acquisition side of things, when I first started utilizing more of these principles, and I should say not when I first started utilizing them, but when I first became vocal about utilizing some of these principles, I didn't fully understand the philosophy. I understood the concepts, but I think this is something that you actually have to do and watch and see to get better at. Like, it's one thing to read about it and think you understand it. It's another thing to see it in practice. You know, and I think in a lot of cases, it's hard to know if you're actually using it. And I'm going to give some examples of that. So in a constraints-led approach, there are three constraints. There's the performer, right? And like I think in a lot of cases, you know, the performer in the past, I talked about their height, their weight, their kind of anatomical makeup is going to dictate some of the positions. You know, a heavyweight lifter might be more comfortable with their feet wider on a squat, for example. But this doesn't just include the mechanical aspects of the lifter. It also includes their past experiences, their emotions, their beliefs. So this is one of the things I really like about a constraints-led approach is it takes into consideration the whole human, not just their muscles, their size, and whatnot. You know, their leverages that everybody wants to talk about. The next one is the environment. You know, where we train at RX. And I would imagine most gyms in Massachusetts, it's warehouse space. You know, not many gyms have air conditioning that are like garage gyms that are outfitted with a few barbells, you know. So it's going to get hot. It's going to get cold. It just kind of comes with being a power lifter in the Northeast. And I think there's benefits to training in those tough conditions. It builds mental toughness. But the environment's not just, it's not just that, right? So obviously at a meet, you have music, you have more people, you have judges, like those things are environmental constraints. But also the group setting is an environmental constraint. So that sociocultural aspect of training, you know, and I know a lot of people don't view powerlifting as a team sport, but it is for us. Everybody helps each other out. They're spotting, they're cheering each other on. Those things have positive impacts. And not only that, you have lifters getting variations that they've never done before, but another lifter has. And seeing them go through the process and get stronger, there's increased motivation, increased buy-in, increased confidence in the program. So like, if everything's going well in a group setting, it just kind of feeds itself. And I think you see this even at the highest of levels. Like, you know, the Boston Red Sox last year basically have the exact same team as they have this year. Last year they won a World Series. They had the best record in baseball. Everything was great. This year there seems to be some clubhouse problems and they're not doing very well. Like, environmental constraints matter. And I know sometimes it's hard for people to grasp their head around, but I think it's an advantage because we are a team and we train as a team that we have. And there aren't, you know, I know Ryan Gleason out in Connecticut, like he's got a similar setup there with his team and he gets good results. And I would imagine that the team setting really helps. On top of that, I'm not sure of many powerlifting teams that actually train together. So it's kind of a cool aspect. And then the last part of it, it's the actual task itself. So this would be the exercise. Or the equipment we use if we want to use a specialty bar or something. I don't. We always use a straight bar, even though we use a lot of variations. The reason for using the straight bar, I guess I'll go into this a little bit. And there's not a ton of information on this, but there's a solid amount on the haptic information and how it changes approaches to a skill. So, for example, there's research that supports that when an athlete grabs a baseball bat or a racket, that there's some type of information that they're picking up on between the length and the weight of, we'll use the baseball bat, of the baseball bat. And what they've done in the research is they'll give the athlete a different size bat and then just kind of, view movement outcome. So like timing changes, their approaches change. So it literally, the size of the equipment changes the movement. So there's something there. And I kind of, you know, if you follow me for a while, you know that, you know, I'm not a big fan of using things like the safety squat bar, and it's for that reason. You know, I think now that's where my argument comes from, where before, I think, and this is good because this kind of gets into the conversation that I want to get into, but before I was kind of breaking it up into, oh, it's more back, not enough legs, so that's why it doesn't carry over well. But I think that's a poor explanation and an inadequate understanding of what's actually happening when we're lifting weights. So I'm actually recording this a couple days after the internet blew up when I had posted a research discussion between two camps. And they're both very well written. And, you know, I'm going to start this off by saying it is okay to disagree. So just because I may have a different stance, as long as, you know, my stance is supported by strong science, you can't get your panties in a bunch at the end of the day over this. It's not a big deal. And like these discussions, disagreeing is how science moves forward. So I had come up with this conclusion, and a lot of my lifters have heard me say this before I had even seen any of this research. I mean, for years I was questioning whether accessories actually carry over to the main lifts, because like it just what we see is that they don't. So, you know, for example, if I took out squats one completely out of my training, and I did leg extension, leg curls, calf raises, cable pull throughs, some type of, and then rows and pull downs or something, right? So we're kind of hitting all the muscles that we would deem important in that squat in more of a bodybuilding style. Is my squat gonna go up? No. And the argument is, and I don't think anybody who thinks that, you know, accessories lead to increases in strength would say that's the case. That's not their argument. Their argument, I think, would be, but it's also important information to know, right? So hypertrophy in and of itself doesn't necessarily lead to strength gains, right? Because I'm probably going to build more muscle mass, and I'm going to build more muscle mass and, you know, strength in those individual exercises in important muscles for the squat. So the argument would be that, oh no, it doesn't, by itself it doesn't, but in conjunction with the squat. Well, if by itself it doesn't, and it only works in conjunction with the squat, and we know that squatting will increase our squat, how do we know that the accessories are actually going to lead to increases in strength? We don't. And like, I've just had this gut feeling that like it doesn't. Now, I'm not saying that accessories are not important. I think they're very important. If you look at my programs, we do a lot of them. But I've changed my mindset on how and why I program accessories. So it's no longer to identify weak muscle groups within the lifts and then to try to get extra work there. Basically, it's, think of the joints that we tend to have a lot of problems at, you know, like people will have elbow pain, they'll have knee pain, back pain, things like that. I think those accessories play an extremely important role to increasing load tolerance at those joints. And hopefully, I mean, it's impossible for me to know this, but I think I will theorize that the increases in load tolerance at those joints can help lifters reduce injury risk. So I think accessories are extremely important. But having a different mindset in programming them, you know, may help me be more effective as a coach in laying out the groundworks of a program. So getting more into the skill side of lifting. So the cool thing about our team is one of our lifters, Ariel, texted me. This was as I'm recording this. So this was last night. She pulls sumo and doesn't like pulling conventional deadlifts very much. But instead of throwing a temper tantrum and being like, I'm not doing this, she asked, why am I doing conventional deadlifts? And these types of conversations are actually extremely important and a necessary part of the way I do programming. I don't write sets and reps, and the fact that we're doing things different from everybody else, you cannot find this information on the internet. So if Ariel decided to pop on the internet somewhere and Google conventional deadlifts for sumo pullers or something like that, she's going to get some information, some positive, some negative. So let's say she even holds on to the positive information. It's talking about, oh, you know, we're going to use it to build your back and whatever. Me and her now would not be on the same page. There was a time that was my, and this is kind of the narrative that I want to update. There was a time that I used that as an explanation. Oh, well, changing angles hits muscles differently. So, you know, that's how we're going to get stronger. You know, the conventional deadlift will be more back. We get your back strong. It should carry over into the sumo deadlift. I don't believe this narrative is actually correct. It's wrong, and the one that I'm going to give you now is probably wrong as well and will be disproven at some point, but it is less wrong. So it's not so much as we're working the back muscles and they're going to get stronger, so that's why her sumo deadlift is going to get stronger, right? The human body, it's an open, complex, dynamic system. There's way more to it than just, we're not just a bag of muscles. When Ariel is doing the conventional deadlift, her start position is not bad. She's pretty quick off the floor because she is a little bit rounded, which I don't have a problem with, right? So this has been another hard part of adopting this type of coaching strategy, because I and even now, still at times, I want to put what I think as a coach is the best technique possible onto somebody else by saying words when they're doing something that I feel is incorrect. And it gets hard sometimes. So especially for beginners, because I want them to like fool around with stuff, you know, and like the error in training, and like they need to figure out what feels best. So that error gives them that feedback in order to be able to make those updates to get better at the variations and stuff. So a lot of times with the beginners, like brand new people, I'll explain to them what I want out of the squat and kind of get them into those positions, you know, in the setup, the head position, the elbow position, like, you know, things like that. From there, I'll walk away, because I know I probably will give them too much feedback. So walking away kind of, I think helps, just keep my bias out of those, situations. So getting back to the conventional deadlift. So when Ariel performs a conventional deadlift, she's pretty quick off the floor, gets up to her knees, and then there's almost like confusion on what to do, you know. My guess, and this is nothing more than a guess, so when you're pulling sumo, by that point, her knees are just about locked in that range of motion under the, like, that timing of it. But here, they're not. They're still pretty bent. So it changes things a little bit. So when she gets to her knees, her torso was straightened way too fast. And then she's stuck in a position where she either will push the knees forward, which will get red lights on the platform for the barbell resting on the thighs. So in order for her to lift heavier weights, I mean, she handled pretty heavy weights doing this. But in order for her to actually be able to lift those heavier weights with platform rules, we got to learn something. Once that bar is at the knees, we got to learn how to lock that out within the rules of the sport. And there is a lot of benefits to this moving forward, even for a sumo deadlift. So I kind of mentioned this in passing a few minutes ago, but we have perceptions of what the movement should be before we even get under that bar and initiate that movement. Our emotions, our beliefs, our past experiences, they formulate a hypothesis on what the best movement strategy is going to be under these circumstances on this given day. So once that movement strategy is hypothesized, it's literally pre-planned. So now we're going to go out there. This is going to be our movement strategy. And this is where it gets difficult. And this is why sometimes fixing technique gets extremely difficult. And if a coach doesn't understand the philosophies behind skill acquisition, this is where they can miss the mark quite easily. So our brains do not want to be wrong. They are predicting this hypothesis based off of the lowest predicted error. So like I was saying before, if we predict the weights to be heavy, a breakdown in technique may be that feedback that we need to prove ourselves right. So it's not like we just go through the world based off of these hypotheses without ever updating them. If the sensory feedback that we get is strong enough to tell our perceptual inference, that predicted hypothesis, that, yo, you're off. You are way off here. It will hopefully update that hypothesis. So in these situations here, the strategy that the pre-planned movement strategy for aerial that goes into the conventional deadlift is exactly what you see. Okay, so the knees pushing forward. There's, we'll call them inefficient breakdowns in technique, but it's against the rules to push your knees forward and rest the bar in there. So we need to update that hypothesis. This is hard for her because she doesn't have any experiences here to know how to fix it. So I need to create an environment that, so now she knows it's incorrect. So I've kind of helped update what's happening there, but she's not going to be able to fix it without some guide back from that sensory feedback. So the way that our bodies work is our brain predicts that hypothesis, and then our senses, and then we kind of go through the world and our senses pick up on all that information. We give it back to the brain and everything gets updated. So I need to do something in her world to update her brain. I'm going to use the word world brain here to make my group of nerd PTs happy. I think they'll appreciate that. So we need to find a way. So there are options that I could do here. I could pause at the knees to give her a second to kind of regroup to think about it. But I'll probably use long tempo deadlifts here, which she's going to absolutely hate. But I'll give her sumo deadlifts on another day so that she can still get some confidence pulling it. We'll call it a compromise, Ariel. So when the bar gets to the knees, she's just moving slow and she can focus on getting those knees locked and then the hips through, and we can just kind of work on the timing. And then once we get it at that speed, we can start to pick it up. I probably don't care so much about picking it up if she's going to pull sumo in competition at this moment in time. But what this is going to do is it's going to give her a larger skill set within the sport, right? So I understand that locking out sumo is very different than locking out a conventional deadlift, but there's complexities to skill acquisition that I think the majority of coaches don't understand. And I'll go out on a limb and I don't think any coaches understand skill acquisition in the sport of powerlifting because we view it as such a low skilled sport. But I would argue that, you know, Ray Williams squatting over 1,000 pounds is not a low skill. That's an extremely high skilled movement. But that's, I guess, an argument for another day. So basically what happens once we correct this and we can get this, it is a correction, right? Because she's not lifting within the rules. So I'll use that word. So once we correct this, what happens is now is Ariel's pre-lift perceptual skill set is much deeper. This over time gives a lifter more flexibility and adaptability to handle different changes in the environment and the task. So even though it may be hard to draw a line between locking out a conventional and locking out a sumo deadlift, having that ability to be flexible and adaptable in skill sets is literally a sign of an elite athlete. Intermediates and novices, so you can group them all together. Novices show a lot of variability, but it's more exploratory variability. It isn't a control of a skill that they're using to their advantage to be able to handle environments and changing environments and changing tasks. Novices are just, it's more random and it's more exploratory so that they can learn how to do that. Intermediates, there's less. So you actually see less variability. So what I would say here, when we're looking at the deadlift for Ariel, I think she hit an all-time triple PR in the conventional. The first two were within the rules. The third one wasn't. Okay, but she locked it out, and it's not like the weight was heavy. And this was over 90% for a triple in an exercise that she's done like three times. So that's pretty amazing to see, right? So the strength is there. It's just we need to get more flexibility and more adaptability within that skill set. And so what I would say is her conventional deadlift, we're kind of in those intermediate stages somewhere. And if we can update that perceptual pre-lift hypothesis and give it more data. So think of it in terms of, I use this example in the, so we have a large group chat and we had this discussion in this group chat. And I think that part's cool too. I don't know many teams that do that same thing. But if you, and I think this is a poor example because I don't think this our bodies and brains and stuff work like a computer, but I think it makes it easy to see. So if you think of our brains, that perceptual pre-lift hypothesis developing piece as like machine learning, the more data it has to go off of, and you know, the more data it has to go off of, the more accurate it's going to be. So if we can just fill that thing up with just a lot of different skill sets at different angles, there is carryover. And it, maybe for reasons we don't even understand. You know, if you go back, might be a little while now into the podcast, but I would talk about variations and using variations in training and how important it is. And my reasons for it would be is we need to use wide stance squats because it hits the quads more close to, because it hits the hips more, close stance squats because they hit the quads more, and lower back. And like there were a lot of like different I was using the differences in what we seem to see on EMG studies with muscles involved at different angles as my reasoning for these variations. And I think this was incorrect. And even when I knew it was incorrect, I didn't like pick up on it. So I've mentioned this a lot of times. I see lifters pitching forward in the squat, and I decided to use high bar wide stance squats for that. So according to the research, like I've said this many times, like most people will say pitching forward in the squat because knee extension demands, so the emphasis of your quads is highest at the bottom of the squat. If they're pitching forward, their quads aren't strong enough. This is a logical, mechanical explanation of how breakdowns within the squat work. And I bought this for a little while. I don't think it's right at all. And I've just, and this is based off of my experiences as a coach. Too bad if it hurts your feelings, because I we're not a bag of muscles, and I don't view it this way anymore. And here's why: high bar wide stance squats seems to fix that pitching forward variation across the board better than anything else I've used. You know, I may need to tweak that high bar wide stance position. Like we may need to use pauses or tempos or whatever for the individual, but that position tends to fix that issue more than any other variation I've used. And this includes, you know, pin squats, I do think are great for that, but also from a skill acquisition perspective, it punishes that pitching forward. And that's what a constraint should do. So a constraint should minimize movement options, where it punishes that inefficient technique and only leaves room for the lifter to choose a better option. So I'm going to give an example of this and how you have to change it for each lifter. And we'll use pin squats. So, and I'm going to use first names here. So Emily and Alyssa both got pin squats leading up into their last meets. They both have similar issues in the squat. For Emily, she'll pitch forward. She squats with a really close stance to begin with. So, you know, it's just, I think it's an angle that she prefers. And as the weight gets heavier, it pushes her around a little bit. Alyssa, I think there's more of what I call panic. I don't think she's like you know, about to cry underneath the weight type of thing because she's like scared or nervous. But you got to remember all these emotions that somebody's feeling when they're lifting. It's not all conscious. So you'll see a loss of breakdown in technique, and it could be a difference, you know, and it's just, it's not like a gradual breakdown either. So like Emily will gradually get pitched forward once the weights start getting up to a certain point. For Alyssa, it's a little bit different. It's like all of a sudden it looks great. It looks great. It looks great. All of a sudden it's broken. I shouldn't say broken, but all of a sudden it's inefficient. The knees are coming in. She's pitching forward a little bit. And I think Alyssa needs to learn how to be comfortable being uncomfortable, grinding out weights. And it's gotten a lot better, and she's put a ton on her squat. Nobody works harder than Alyssa. And she's going to be listening to this and editing it. So either I have to say that or it's true. No, I'm just kidding, Alyssa. That, it's true. Nobody works harder than Alyssa, and she'll do anything I ask her to do. So in this scenario, I gave them both pin squats. And from here, you don't know how that is going to act as a constraint, or even if it is going to act as a constraint for each individual lifter. I think it's a generally good exercise for people, but once you narrow it down for the lifter, some alterations might need to be made. So I noticed the first time that Emily was doing sets of five, I think, she's pitching forward off the pins, but still has the strength to just lock it out. It's like, okay. So under this circumstance, this is not a constraint for Emily. It is not constraining her movement options. I literally decided to change things up with her on the spot. So my gut feeling said to go in this route. And I knew at some point I could get that heavy enough. That shit's not going to move. She actually surprised me by how much she was able to lift that first time. I was like, holy shit. But we got it up there to a point where if she started to move forward at all, that chest started to collapse, the hips started to rise before that bar broke, the weight was just too heavy to be able to move it. And we just did singles for, I think, about 3 weeks. You know, and I think if I held myself to a belief that volume was true, right? And we need to build hypertrophy in order to build strength and all of these other, like, generally accepted ideas, I probably wouldn't have changed things. So I made a decision on the spot. She, you know, she ended up hitting a PR in that. At the end of the day, that's what we're trying to do, right? For Alyssa, a little bit different. Alyssa's strong too, so I'm able to put weight on there, and she's able to have her technique break down and still lift weight on these lifts. So for her, I decided to do something a little bit different. So yeah, I could have overloaded it, right? But here's what's going to happen with Alyssa when it's overloaded. Because remember when I was saying that it looks good, and then it's just, there's no gradual decrease in technique. It just happens. So the weight will be light, or she'll be capable of doing it. I put more weight on there. It just won't move off the pins. And I want to address that panic that Alyssa has in that squat. And like I said before, and I'm going to reemphasize this because I think this is an often misunderstood piece of emotions. It's not all conscious. I don't get vibes from being around Alyssa during competitions or during heavy lifts. I mean, don't get me wrong. There have been days, you know, that she has been openly like, I'm kind of nervous about this, like her test before nationals. But for the most part, I don't get those vibes from her. I think this is more of a subconscious panic that happens under the heavier weights. So what I like to do to address panic is just spend more time in those positions where I see that. So for her, we brought it down to the pins, and then she took it off the pins an inch or two and paused for 2 seconds. So, you know, one, she's going to have to move slower because of the pins. You're not going to slam the bar into the pins because it'll fall off your back. So we get a controlled tempo on the eccentric because of the pins. And then from there, she's going to hold her position, and the bar can't move up right away. right? So like a lot of times what can happen, so this is what you saw with Emily, is she can get enough speed off of those pins to bypass that bad position, to be able to get through that bad position that she's in and lock out the weight. But if I make Alyssa pause off of those pins, it forces her to slow down and control her position. And you won't be able to pause off those pins if that bar is pushing you around. If her knees come in and her chest falls forward, she will not be able to pause. And she got up to some pretty heavy weights with this, I think. We might have taken 315 on this, which was a pretty sick squat. So, you know, I think those things. And at the meet, she ended up getting red lights for depth on her third, which would have been a pretty big PR. I think her second might have been a PR, matched her best or something anyways. But so even with the red lights, the squat, you know, it was close for depth. It moved really well. I felt her confidence at the meet was high. Like I didn't get those same vibes that I was getting in the gym, beforehand. So, you know, I think it's got better. And now it's a different issue. We got to work on it. We're going to continue to work on it. It's not like that problem's just going to go away. You got to remember it's a nonlinear process. So right now she's doing some long concentric pauses. We widen her stance a little bit so the depth's not an issue. And she's just going to still spend a lot of time. And I think I think it's 5 seconds on the way up on the tempos that I'm giving her. And I think for those, and even on those, the first time that she did them, as soon as she hits the hole, you can see the speed that she gets like through that hard part of the squat, that hardest part for her. And then she'll want to hit the brakes and then get her 5 seconds that way. So like really fast and then really slow. So being able to maintain a normal pace through that will just hopefully build more comfort in those uncomfortable positions. And I'm not trying to update her conscious pieces here. I want that subconscious to be comfortable being in those harder positions. And so in doing this, it's more, you know, and there's stuff I'm going to bring out. The internet's going to blow up when they see these things, but as of the time I'm recording this, next week I'm going to start wrapping Kerry's knees for squats. So we just hit 300 on a pin squat. That strength in that squat is there. And, you know, we've talked about this, and this is the feedback that I think is extremely important using a constraints-led approach. Because Kerry's like, well, I feel confident when the pins are there that I can move those big weights. Well, what are you doing that's giving you that option, right? You're controlling your positions on the way down, right? Don't try to move too fast, right? And obviously, don't move too slow, but control your positions on the way down. And from there, like, there's patience for her off the pins because she knows it's going to take a second to move. She has to show that same patience in her comp squat. Because what happens in her comp squat is when she goes to change directions, you'll see the hips shoot up just a little bit. And Kerry's got good back strength, and she gets decent speed from her back to correct that and lock out big weights. She's got a huge squat for her weight class. But obviously the strength to hit 300 is there. She just has to be able to control it on the way down and control her positions on the way up and just be patient and trust her strength. And that's something we've discussed and we've worked on. And, you know, one of the things that she said is seeing the weight, feeling it on her back and lifting it gives her confidence to do it. Right. And I've seen this play out over the last 2 years. Like, it's very rare that I'm not even sure if she's ever not, maybe at one meet she hit something in training but didn't at the competition. There were some other issues going on there. But for every other instance, if she hits it in the gym, I'm 100% confident she'll hit it on the platform. So I've seen this play out. So wrapping her knees and handling bigger weights for a period of time, like there's to see 315 on that bar, to feel it on your back, to take it down, to lock it out, and to do lots of reps with that is going to increase her confidence under those heavier weights. And I think there's a lot of skill that will allow her to do that because those heavier weights push you around a lot differently than lighter ones. Especially when you're starting to get into weights that not many people in that weight class touch, period. And I think that's another thing. Like, you know, for me as a lifter, I've been fortunate enough that I've always been around people who lift a lot of freaking weight. So I've seen, you know, 600, 700 pounds on a squat. I've seen 800 pound, you know, 700, 800 pound deadlifts. So the fact that I've seen those things happen, I know that people can do them and like, and all of these things. I think for Kerry, she knows she's the smallest lifter on the team. And, you know, even, you know, 57 kilogram lifters aren't that much heavier. They're not squatting 315 on our team. They have big squats, you know, like 270 plus, which is, those are really good squats for 125 pound female lifter. But female lifters, we have multiple. But for her, I think just not seeing people in her weight class on a daily basis hit those same weights, it becomes a different mental challenge for her that I think we can address in different ways. And we'll see. Another one I'm going to bring up is Dave and Emo Danielle. They're going to get like half squat pin squats, and we're going to overload the freaking shit out of it. Both of them lose, and I'm using quotations here, lose their upper back halfway up on that squat, right? It's not an upper back weakness. And this is what, like, changing my frame of mind, right, has hopefully opened the door for me to be more flexible and adaptable in my decision making while understanding a framework better should yield better results. So they're going to get these half squat pin squats because they, in quotations, lose their upper back on the way up in the squat. Now, both of them get good enough speed out of that hole where they can get away with it up to bigger weights. Dave squatted 700 pounds, and Emo Danielle at 138 pounds squats over 300 as well. So for them, those bigger weights, you're just, to me, that's the thing that needs to be corrected the most. You can get away with that until you can't, right? And if we want to move bigger weights, we're going to have to get better at that. But both of them, now they've both done pin squats and it has helped in the past, but we're still seeing that same, this is known as an attractor state, that same attractor state under heavier weights. So how can I help to update what happens in those positions? So one, by telling them why they're going to be doing this exercise is important, because they need to know why. I think that's important for them to update that skill set. So being in this position here, I'm taking away the speed that they're able to generate to be able to bypass those shitty positions. And they're going to have to move it straight off the pins, keeping their elbows under the bar, their chest tall, and keeping in their legs as long as possible. That is literally how they're going to have to move it off those pins, and we're going to lift this fucking heavy. Like, they're probably going to start touching weights that they've never touched before on their back using a variation like this. And I think that might have a psychological effect too. Now, in the past, if we just viewed the human body as a bag of muscles, you know, I would say that none of these, so the knee wraps or the high pin squats, are a good idea because the knee extension demands at the bottom of the squat, you know, the wraps are doing the work of the quads, with the pins, you're not even getting there. So the quads aren't going to be strong enough to actually lift raw squats or whatever the argument would be. I don't think that narrative is correct. It's not like I'm just going to take out all other squats and we're only going to squat with knee wraps and only squat high. Like, that's not what we're going to do. There's going to be other days of squats. You know, I'm not, in the beginning, I probably won't throw in a second squat with those high pin squats, because I just don't know how it's going to affect the lifters if they're lifting really heavy weights. They might be really tired after it, but maybe we can handle something a little bit different afterwards. I don't know, but they're going to have another squat day, at least one. Maybe we do two because of that. You know, maybe it doesn't beat them up so much, but, you know, we can come back. We can just get some work and, you know, make sure we're putting it into the whole lift. I think this will have a bigger carryover than me trying to do a bunch of, you know, and I've used these variations in the past, and obviously they have worked because their squats have gone up a ton over a period of time. But I've used a lot of pauses on the halfway up and whatnot, but we can only lift so much weight like that. And I think there's something different about 700 pounds than there is about, you know, a 600 pound single pause halfway up. You know, they need to touch that weight, and they need to be able to maintain those positions with those weight, with that weight within those lifts. And I think we're going to have much greater success doing it that way than we would just carrying on, like thinking that we have to make sure that we're strengthening the quads at the bottom of the squat. Now, if we view it as a skill, we don't just view, you know, the performer has muscles, and that's part of it. But like the internet blew up when I shared this, I don't think that hypertrophy is a necessary component to have in a strength program. And here's why this framework is guiding me in a different direction. They all have put on muscle mass training the way that we do. We're doing multiple sets with one to two sets at or near failure on a daily basis. Okay, that's going to build enough muscle. We don't need to necessarily focus on building more muscle. Under my program and with my framework and my thinking of things, which clearly is very different from everybody else because nobody else is viewing it in the same manner or doing the same thing, I do not think more is better here. I do not think a dedicated time to putting on muscle mass is a necessary requirement in a powerlifting program, because the lifters are going to put on the muscle mass training appropriately. If you are training for powerlifting, your body will adapt to be good at powerlifting. Part of these adaptations that it goes through is putting on muscle mass to be able to perform a task. It's a byproduct of training. I just don't think that more is necessary here. Now, you would look at my programs and probably think that they're very similar to people who are saying otherwise, because there are a lot of accessories and stuff. But again, it's more, I'm coming at it from a framework where I want to build load tolerance at joints for future increases in volume and or to try to reduce injury risk as much as possible. So we'll do a lot of like single leg stuff, but I don't view it as, oh, I'm doing single leg stuff to build the quads. No, it's a byproduct of training, and single leg stuff by itself is not making your squat stronger. And I actually don't think that there's, in the majority of cases, I don't think single leg lifts carry over to the squat itself. My single leg lifts have gone way down over the years, and my squat's gone way up. Like, I just don't, there's just not a strong correlation there. However, it loads the knee joint extra times. So we're building tolerance at that joint. A ton of extra back work, right? Most people are afraid to hurt their backs in this sport. Like, I think if you ask somebody, that's their number one fear. So I think it being the number one fear, and also probably being the, we'll call it injury that, you know, we'll call back pain the injury here. For most missed training days, I bet back pain's number one, and I bet there's not a coincidence that the fear of hurting your back, getting sore hurting your back, but being afraid now turns that into an injury, and now you miss time. But I've discussed that on other podcasts, and I'm not doing that today. So doing more back work helps to alleviate some of that pain, increases load tolerance of the back, and hopefully reduces the risk of injury. So instead of looking at Dave's lifts in the squat, right, or Emo Danielle's lifts in the squat where they're losing their back a little bit, instead of looking at that as, oh, I got to like do more volume in the upper back because the upper back gets stronger, no, we're going to address that skill within the lift itself. And, you know, Dave gets some cranky knees sometimes. So we're going to continue to build load tolerance at his knees, and that's going to be the focus of his accessory work. Emo Danielle will get some, you know, neither one of them are missing training days ever because of these things, but it doesn't mean I don't want to address them. But her lower back at times gets stiff on her. So that'll be more of a priority for her. And like, that's just kind of how I've started to run accessories, as opposed to focusing on, okay, these probably don't carry over, but I don't know what else to do. So that's what's going to guide the framework for my accessory work. You know, we're doing something very different. Viewing it as a skill is very different. I expect some of the negative consequences on the internet when I post what we're doing. But it's also how discussions can move forward. And hopefully, you know, the strength and conditioning world is just, it's a unique one. If we took powerlifting out and put another sport in there, and I know everybody is probably like, powerlifting's not a skilled sport. It's a low skilled sport. Technique doesn't matter. And like, whatever else they want to say. That's fine. To each their own. But the way that it's viewed is, it seems like everybody out there is just so absolutely sure that we know the answers to this stuff, that volume and hypertrophy and average intensities and technique and all of these aspects of training. It's just like all of these coaches and lifters are so sure that they know all the answers. At the end of the day, you know, this is a competitive sport, so them being so sure makes me a little happy, because I know that they're wrong, and I know that I am less wrong, and the results are gonna speak for themselves at the end of the day. You can follow me on Instagram. It's KWCan. Follow our team, Precision Powerlifting Systems. Stay strong, Boston.